We never talked the Halo season 2 finale.
Well, this shit slapped.
It's it just like you say, it kind of ends where the games begin, like we thought.
Welcome to episode 49 of Podcast X. I am your host, Ben Kendrick. I am joined by my co-host, Mr. Rob Keys.
Hello, we're back. Weekly. I'm back to a week's weekly schedule, of course. We're so consistent.
Yeah, we're doing great. We're doing great. And special guest Kofi Outlaw is here.
What's up?
I am surrounded by both of my dogs who are looking at me like I don't know what I'm supposed to be doing with them. So if anybody hears a dog bark or I don't know, my entire podcasting setup collapsed. It's because one of my dogs did something insane. But we are here today.
I had a cat derail an entire show recently. Pulled out a cord pulled out a cord in my co-host's computer. Shut the whole computer down in the middle of an interview.
Right. Cat's the worst.
Yeah.
It's true.
That was like one of those like pandemic era things though that was like actually kind of fun when people were doing interviews and their cats just started like, you know, like stomping on their keyboards or whatever. And they're like trying to keep their cool while they're talking to The Rock or something.
No, I like the ones where the kids walk in the background, like that famous BBC thing or whatever.
The kid comes wheeling
in. Get out of the room. Yeah.
All right. Well, today we are going to be talking Ghostbusters, Frozen Empire, X-Men 97 and Roadhouse. We're going to try and squeeze that in at the end here. So, I am happy to have you start off on Ghostbusters, Kofi. I think Kofi and I've seen it. Rob hasn't. But we'll tell you what we think, Rob.
I guess that's is that the toss to me?
I guess.
I got a better way. Yo, right, Kofi, does Bustin' feel good?
I mean, that's the title of my review. Classic Bustin' still feels good.
Oh, really?
I'm never going to stop saying that. Yeah, it is. I reviewed it for comicbook.com. I gave it 3 out of 5 stars. I said, Afterlife was a heavier movie. It was about legacy. It was this very kind of meta-minded thing about the Ghostbusters legacy, what it meant to like Jason Reitman, the son of Ivan Reitman, and all that. This is more of a back to basics for this new Spangler family Ghostbusters, because these movies are set in the same universe as the originals. And this one is a back to basics one. They're fully established. This isn't how they came back. They are back. They're just getting in the Ghostbusters status quo. And I think in that sense, it's a lot more fun. It reminds me of what the fun of Ghostbusters is. This movie, the co-writer of Afterlife, Gail Keenan, directs this one with Jason Reitman kind of sliding over and just being co-writer this time instead of directing. And I think between the two of them, they really get more so than a lot of other people who've tried remakes of this, what the fun of the original film is, particularly the first one, which is that it's really a comedy movie with this really weird premise about, part detective, part scientists, you know, set in the supernatural. And it's a lot of what made that film famous was Bill Murray, Harold Ramis, Dan Aykroyd, and Rick Moranis, and Sigourney Weaver, all these people getting to riff. And there's a lot of weird scenes in Ghostbusters. If you watch it again, it's a pastiche of a lot of weird scenes and sequences loosely held together by them just trying to, you know, flesh out the concept of what their ghostbusting business is and starting to pick up on clues that there's this larger force at work in Gozer. And then you have this big action third act. So I think this film does a good job in the sense of remembering that this is a comedy series and doing a lot more. I mean, the other ones know that, but the Ghostbusters comedy was weird. It's weird. It's offbeat. It's this mix of horror, adult comedy, and just a lot of kind of slapstick comedy with even sexual overtones, like the sliming and all that stuff and the ectoplasm. And so this movie, in a very modern way, does a lot of that and is not afraid to get weird and is not afraid to get a little bit scarier than a lot of what Ghostbusters that we've seen before. So in that sense, I think it works. There's a very large cast. I like the bantering between them and all those scenes and how fun and weird those are. but as a narrative, as a story, it's a complete overstuffed mess of things.
Yeah.
And there is no clear thematic through line to it. There's no larger thing like with Afterlife, which had this major thematic thing that comes together in this very poignant ending, right? This is more just kind of as if this was like the original Ghostbusters cartoon, in that there's just a bunch of sitcom-y problems that everybody has.
Yeah.
Like Finn Wolfhard's running around and he's 18. He wants to be treated like an adult. McKenna Grace's character wants to be recognized for her genius, even though she's getting treated like a kid. You know, the parents are just trying to get through all this teen angst. You know, Ray and Winston are arguing about how involved or how responsible it is to be putting people up to ghost busting. Like, there's all these things happening, right?
And what to do for their own, like, golden years and stuff, too.
Yeah. That's kind
of, it's weird. Like, they throw a really weird kind of thing towards the end with Ray's stance like that. Like, it is what you're, I mean, I'll let you get back to your point, but
no, you can, if we have something to say, I got a starburst to chew. Go for it.
Well, I mean, I felt really similarly about like a lot of what you're kind of highlighting. It's like, it feels more like a cartoon or like a kind of a, you know, a riff on the original Ghostbusters, like Ghostbusters 2 or something. It feels like a riff on Ghostbusters 2, where it's like, you know, team's kind of established, they're running around New York, you know, the mayor's frustrated with them, and they're causing damage, but they're also saving the day. And they kind of prove why ultimately you need to have Ghostbusters, even though their methods are somewhat unorthodox or something. But yeah, I mean, as far as like, I think McKenna Grace like really shines in it. Like, I kind of wish they like,
yeah, no, she's definitely, not to say this in a creepy way, but she's definitely like growing up. And I mean, she looks very different in this. She's obviously matured a lot between these two films. And like, yeah, she's ready to take on material that's a little bit more serious. And I can't wait to hatch this conversation with you, because if there's anything we know, we can handle generational stories very well. So yeah, but there's also like a whole kind of semi-queer love story to this that's really unorthodox with her character, which, you know, clearly is not in the marketing, but when I went to see it, I was like, oh, but it is one of the more compelling subplots of the film, but it's also fucking weird because it's with a dead girl, right? And they don't shy away from that. There's a lot of jokes about how she's a dead girl and how they can't really interact. And there's a very, the thing that I wrote about, I mean, I wrote like a Who Dies and Ghostbusters piece, but one of the things I did highlight in that was like, listen, I know a lot of parents are asking about this one, like, is it too scary with, you know, Garaka, the ice demon and all that?
Yeah.
But I was like, the actual thing I don't think most people will probably get upset about is kind of this sequence that has these metaphorical overtones to self-harm and things like that, that is really more surprising and risky. But I feel some kind of way about it. But at the same time, I was like, at least Ghostbusters is not afraid to take these swings and get weird, because this is the movie where somebody does something weird like that.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. I mean, I think she really does kind of carry the movie, but I think you're right. It's not in a way that feels like the movie was written for her. So it almost feels like, you know, there's another like 30 minutes of this movie where everybody's arcs are a little bit more fleshed out, and then they honed in on this one and they cut all that other stuff. Like, it doesn't feel like anybody sat down to say, okay, this is McKenna's entry, and so we're going to build this thing around her and give everybody else a little bit to do. It's like they were sort of like, let's give everybody something to do, and then let's figure out which of these things is the most impactful. And they kind of hone it down to her. But I mean, I'm completely with you. I was massively entertained. I would love to see another one that's, you know, in this similar tone and takes the same swings, makes the same mistakes. Like, I don't think it's like a huge problem in a Ghostbusters movie this day and age that, like, you know, I don't know, like Finn Wolfhard's arc is not as impactful as like another cast member's or something.
Yeah, we would not have given a fuck. Like, we wouldn't have given a fuck about all that. I think I wrote in my review that the smart people here were the editors, who were like, you guys got a lot going on, so let's just like find the best sequences and like just put them together and there's your movie. And that's basically what they do.
But you
wouldn't be surprised if there's what's up. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No. You go ahead. Go ahead.
No, I wouldn't be surprised if there's a lot of deleted scenes and a whole bunch of other stuff they cut away. But they just pick the best, kind of funniest, weirdest sequences and put them together, and it works as a movie. And I was like, okay.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Like, you can tell they were like working with a lot, and there is weird like there is weird stuff. Like you have Carrie Coon in this movie and she has virtually nothing to do. Like even Paul Rudd's like Gary Gruberson or whatever has kind of this arc with McKenna Grace's Phoebe Spengler about kind of like, what is his relationship? Is he her dad? Is he, you know, like just kind of a friend? He used to be her teacher. So you can kind of see like there's these moments where he's tethered to her sort of story being sort of front and center, and he gets a few more sort of things to do. But I mean, Finn Wolfhard is mostly chasing Slimer around the whole movie. And then Carrie Coon is there just like, there's literally a scene.
Yeah. I was about to say, if you're going to nail it, they don't hide this fact. There's literally a scene early on of her establishing what her fucking commitment to this movie is.
Yeah, exactly. And there's like, I mean, there's a scene where she's just like on a couch, like eating Cheetos, and Finn is like acting in the background, talking about like how he's trying to do something. And I mean, she doesn't even turn around to look at him. And, you know, it's just kind of like, she's a Ghostbuster now. That's sort of her thing. And then when the going gets tough, she almost kind of packs up and says, fuck it. So it's like, it's weird to have, I mean, Carrie Coon is clearly doing a lot more heavy lifting in the previous one because of the relationship with her, you know, estranged father and stuff like that. And so for all intents and purposes, it's fine, but it's weird to have such a talented actress like Carrie Coon that did so much in the first one, just kind of like sitting around eating, you know, like
she deserves, yo, Carrie Coon has done a lot of intense stuff. She deserves a paycheck, you know?
Yeah.
You deserve to have some fun and collect a paycheck. And after Ant-Man, so does Paul Rudd. Like, and they gave him more daddy stuff to do, better daddy stuff to do in this one and that one. So he probably needed that, you know?
Yeah. No, 100%. And I actually had that thought watching the movie about Carrie Coon, where I was kind of like, man, this is so, you know, she's in the Gilded Age. She's been in The Leftovers. She's done all these other things. And then, you know, you have this movie. It's like, where does this fit in? It's like, oh, well, you know, it's fine if she just wants to like show up and be in a goofy movie. Like, I'm totally cool with that.
Yeah, I'm like, the thing about that I like about this movie is it doesn't try to adhere to this weird kind of egalitarian idea of ensemble movies that we've created. Like, everybody must have balanced screen time. No, fuck no, they don't. Some people need to be in the front. Some people are just funny side characters. And some people would be annoying if we got too much of them. So, like, I think this movie balances things very, very well. Like, we didn't need more from Carrie Coon. We did her whole arc in the first one. And in this one, her kids think they're grown. And she literally is like, fuck it. You think you're grown? Be grown. I'm going to be sitting here eating Cheetos, playing on my phone. Which is very much a modern mom thing to do. You know, I can tell you that. That's a very real thing. So, and her just kind of sitting back. And most of the movie, she's just like, look, I can't do shit. These are teenagers. And that's fucking what a teenage mom is like. And so, you know, I got that. I didn't need it. And Finn Wolfhard, like, just enough of him. I didn't need too much of him. That'd have been annoying as shit if I had to keep doing his angsty stuff this movie.
Yeah.
So it was great that we got to, like, and him just chasing Slimer and keep getting gooed on was, you know.
Yeah, pretty fun.
It's funny. Maybe not in Nickelodeon documentary week funny, but, like, it would have been funny. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I mean, that's definitely true. I'm about to get a package, so I may let you, like, Rob, do you have questions that you can ask?
Yeah,
go deal with this.
Not many. I was curious about Patton Oswalt and Kumail's roles and how they factor in. On the comedy side, I guess.
Yeah, there's a lot of cameos in this, and a lot of people who just obviously wanted to be in a Ghostbusters film.
Totally.
Patton Oswalt is literally Patton Oswalt in this. He's like this repository of like, he works at the library or some institute. Yeah, he works at the library. They go back to the library from the first film, The Lions Outside, and he works there, and he's the geek at the library who knows all the old supernatural stuff that people don't really know about. And he's like super nerd of the library. And he's like, oh, you want knowledge about like that? And so he takes them to the stacks under the library with like, you know, their real collection. He's like, yeah, this is the real library. And he's that guy. And so it's basically Patton Oswalt doing his, you know, his famous nerd dissertation and being able to do that in a Ghostbusters movie about supernatural stuff. So he's the guy who explains and does the exposition about who Garaka is, the ancient ice demon and all that. So he delivers that part. And Kumail Nanjiani is part of, in this very crowded movie, one of the other plots is to defeat the ice demon. There's been this line of warriors who got him into the prison in the first place. And Kumail Nanjiani is the latest in that line, but he has no idea. So he's the one who sells the prison. He sells the ice demon's prison to Ray, which kicks off the events of this because this demon could communicate with other ghosts. So bringing it to the Ghostbusters is like the worst fucking idea ever. And but Camille Nanjiani then finds out, like, you know, the key master instead, he's the fire master, and he has to master kind of basically fire bending in order to defeat this demon. But he's a total Chad. Like, he's like some New York Chad who just sits in this skinny apartment reselling shit. Like, that's what right. he does. He buys shit and resells it. And so he's just a total Chad. And he has no idea how to do this. And so it's just a whole arc about trying to get the most unlikely, unspiritual guy to fucking learn firebending. And he's pretty entertaining and anchors his yeah. part of the movie pretty well.
He's pretty fun, because, like, there's a scene with him and Bill Murray. It's like they do a good job, yeah. I think, of, like, pairing people too, because Pat, you were talking about the ensemble and how they're just like, you know, we don't really give a fuck how much we develop these people. Like, some people are just there just to do shit. And, like, Patton Oswalt is just there to do shit and, like, tell a story and basically kind of, like, give you the backstory on this, you know, frost demon thing. And, like,
Garaka.
Yeah. And like, you know, he's playing off of, like, Ray Stantz and, like, you know, the Spengler kid or whatever, like, you know, McKenna Grace's character. So it's like, that juxtaposition is also present with, like, Bill Murray and, you know, Nanjiani. So it's like, there's like a lot of just kind of fun stuff of seeing, like, these comedy legends that you used to love, like, paired up with kind of people who have that same kind of energy, like, weird energy now that are in, like, modern Hollywood. That stuff definitely, like, really works, I think. And it is just where you're sort of like, they got a lot going on. They got all these people in it. Just, like, let these people vibe. And that's kind of, like, some of the best moments in the movie are just, like, those people playing off each other.
Yeah. I legitimately laughed out loud at least twice in the theater, like, burst out laughing at least twice in this movie.
Yeah.
I forget about exactly what, but there are a lot of, like Ben said, just the scenes of who you get vibing together. Like, Patton Oswalt, Ray, and Dan Aykroyd, and McKenna Grace all being these super duper nerds nerding out together is, like, hilarious. Yeah. And also, like, kind of throwing jabs at each other, because, you know, nerds don't ever fucking socially function together really well. So they're kind of, like, fucking with each other, but also, like, you know, fascinated by the same nerdy shit. And it's hilarious. Yeah. Even the little side character kid they throw in here, Podcast.
Yeah.
Who could be, like, such a terrible addition to a movie, is pretty funny.
Yeah. Yeah. He has, like, a whole shtick with, like, with Stance. Like, they're doing, like, a podcast together, basically, or, like, a YouTube, you know, like, video series. And
Jesus.
There's just, like, there's funny shit with that too. But, like, that is one of the things, though, I will say, that trying to get those original kids that were in, you know, the last one in this one, maybe one of the hardest shoves I've ever seen in a movie, of just being like, yeah, fuck, they're here too. Like, you know, it's like literally one of the kids, like, has to lie to his parents about, like, being at space camp instead of actually, like, being, you know, like, Ray Stance's, you know, like, assistant or whatever, because it's, like, such a stretch to get them actually in this movie. But, you know, it's still fun to have them. It's like, you know, it's still fun to have them there. I don't, like, have any hate for that, but it's like, that's how hard this movie tries to, like, get everybody into the movie.
Okay, that leads to another question then. How does the film end with those kids in particular, in terms of setting up the next installment?
Boston still feels good. New York needs more Boston.
Yeah. There's a subplot to the movie, which maybe you guys talked about when I was grabbing this package, that is, like, the next generation of ghost busting. So, like they...
Yeah, I didn't even get into all that. Yeah.
Yeah, so there's Winston, like, a whole... Yeah, go ahead. Yeah,
basically, Winston builds a whole other wing where it's like a Ghostbuster science center where they actually research ghosts. And you get Celeste O'Connor, Madam Webb, Celeste O'Connor from the first film as Lucky Domingo. She comes back and is, like, a scientist. There's another one who I forget the comedian's name, but he plays, like, the lead scientist. And, like, yeah, so they're kind of fleshing out as, like, an organization by the end. And they all have shit to do.
Yeah, like, and theoretically, you could take that, Rob, like, and do something bigger with it. Like, you could bring in more characters or have a reason why some of these 18-year-old, you know, farm kids are now living in the big city and, you know, operating in New York and stuff. And there, you could bring in more Ghostbusters. Like, it doesn't just have to be this group of people that's ghostbusting, because, like, there's literally a whole facility full of, like, people who are studying ghosts. And, like, that's kind of small scale in this one. There's probably, like, you know, five or six people that you see in that facility, But the idea is also that they're building like a bigger version of the containment unit that'll like hold more ghosts, and you know, like it's kind of like
a basically Ghostbuster upgrade time, because it's like Hollywood contracts. They're like, yeah, we have this shit for so long since the 80s, and like now it's time to actually like upgrade it. And so they're building, like, they're literally and figuratively building the new Ghostbusters.
Interesting.
And ironically, to Ben's point, like during the news cycle today, like earlier today, as we kind of get done with this crazy week, they put out that, it seems like the producers are kind of turning this into the feat. Like, this will be after this movie, I think they've realized who to focus on. And like, yeah, Phoebe Spangler will be kind of like the center point, is what they're kind of indicating.
Yeah.
Who's McKenna Grace.
Yeah. If it makes money, well, hopefully it does. I know that the reviews were kind of mixed, but I think the early box office projections had it slightly above the last one, but that came out like 2021 during the pandemic, right? So they're hoping for a lot of walk up.
Now, I mean, ticket sales. We know like the ebb and flow. Like, this isn't going to be big at the box office because everybody is spending that Dune 2 money right now.
Yeah.
And like, that's just unfortunately, but that's the business. So this should get a bigger audience than it probably will, but then it'll hit streaming and then everybody will be like, oh, fuck, that's what happened with Afterlife, I feel like that grew on people after it hit streaming.
It did, for sure.
And it's like, this one will be like, when this comes out and people watch this on like a Saturday night, they're going to be like, oh, shit, that was a whole lot of fun. It's like Transformers slowly crept up last year.
Yeah.
And people were just like, finally saw that and went to Netflix or some shit. And like,
yeah. I hope so. It's a good IP, and obviously to Sony, it's critical. So I'm sure they'll make sequels regardless.
They need to kind of figure out what they're going to do with the OG crew, because like, it's fun to see them, and there's probably like a little enough of them in here that it doesn't like overstay its welcome. I think the Ray Stantz stuff like starts to feel a little bit like it's taking up space for some of the new people, but. Like, in general, I think they've done that okay, but I don't think you can just, like, keep bringing these guys back in every movie and have them show up for the final battle and stuff. Like,
well, I think they've done a good job establishing that this is in the universe of the originals, and what they kind of got to do is just have the old ones be there without having to...
Yeah, just cameos, whatever, in the background.
Like, we know they're around, or just, like... Like, I sent Ray an email, and he got back to me in the next one. This one is probably the most balanced application of the old and the new we're gonna get, and I think they did it really well in this one, so let's just quit while we're ahead. Because obviously, like, certain people, like Dan Aykroyd's game to keep playing with this, he created this, like, he'll keep doing this and hamming it up until the fucking day is out. Ernie Hudson's just a professional who's been collecting a check and has, you know, is still in this acting game collecting checks. And Bill Murray just shows up a couple times just to say for the fuck of it and for his buddies, right?
That's it.
You can tell he's not interested in this shit.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, even his kind of lines when he's like in there and stuff are like, he's mostly just showing up and doing, you know, doing kind of the shtick. Whereas like, there is a bit more like meat and heart to like what's going on with like, you know, with Ray and Winston and stuff. But I was thinking about this though when I was in the theater. It's like, I know we just like jettisoned the female Ghostbusters, but do you ever see a scenario where like these two, because it's kind of established in this one, like there's a possibility for like more ghostbusting teams, and like, yeah, this is the prime team kind of holding down the firehouse and stuff like that, but I don't know, it still feels like this weird vestigial sort of organ that it, like, wasn't as bad as it got, you know, I mean, people are gonna get mad at me for saying this, but it's like, that wasn't like an objectively bad movie.
I disagree, but I think the challenge there is not so much, like, I think there's a cool, I'll say this, I think it's a fun possibility down the road where like they have their version of a multiverse or whatever the explanation is, or a side team, and they cameo as another quad.
They've already painted themselves into this multiverse corner.
Oh, well, there you go.
That's totally established in this one for the
moment. Okay, so that's your answer in the future. But I know, like, the crew, it's Paul Feig or however you pronounce his name, and that crew, the Bridesmaids crew versus like the Reitman family crew and the OGs. Like, there was not much studio or internal love for the other one, which is why they just quickly pushed that to the side. Yeah. I think it was a terrible film, only because it wasn't funny. Like, how does that crew go from Bridesmaids, which was one of the funniest things I've ever seen in theaters, to that film, which didn't make me smile once. It was just like the comedy was just lost. I don't know what happened, but
it was just, it wasn't weird. It was just like Ghostbusters in the most generic way, like possible.
Yeah. It was very generic. Like, yeah.
And that was like the problem. Like it didn't like this one, they didn't get weird. And like Kristen Wiig and them, they can get weird. So it was just like so polished. I feel like they were scared to just get into it and really like try to make their own weird comedy movie. They were trying to make everybody happy with a Ghostbusters movie, and they didn't. I mean, although like Ghostbusters does have the advantage of not having to be like multiverse like Marvel or DC, it's the spirit realm. So, you know, you just say realm instead of universe and you're good. Like some portal is just like, oh, there's a Ghostbusters from another realm. How'd you get here? And that'd be fun.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm kind of interested to see if they end up doing that, because I just like, I don't know. I guess I enjoyed that more than, you know, maybe you guys did. I'm not saying I'm like a huge advocate for it, but it's like the conversation around it was so toxic and so intense. Like, I don't think it deserved all that hate personally, but
no. It'd be funny if they were dead and they just made like, they just really stuck it to people by coming back as like spirits or something and being like, oh yeah, we're super dead. Like, yeah, we went out, we did a mission, we died, like super dead.
That would be funny. Yeah, no, I mean, I think Kofi and I have summed it up pretty well. I mean, if you're a Ghostbusters fan, you're going to probably love it. It's, you know,
Boston makes me feel good.
It feels very in line with those old movies, like in a way that maybe even the last one didn't. Not for better, for worse. I think the last one is, you know, holistically probably like a better movie, but it's not necessarily. I mean, this one is just kind of a tour de force of comedy and entertainment type movie. So, all right, cool. That's Ghostbusters. You guys want to talk?
Wait, what about Slimer? Do you guys talk about Slimer?
Oh yeah, I mean, it's awesome to see Slimer.
What, does he do much in this? Like, what's his thing? What's his gag?
He's there's because of Garaka and what Garaka can do, kind of summoning up other ghosts to his side. It just starts to, like the first film, it starts to cause a lot of spiritual activity. So there's a lot of ghosts hovering around Ghostbusters HQ, because the beginning establishes that Ghostbusters HQ is like built on this line between the spirit world and the real world. And that, you know, what that containment unit is much more pivotal than like we think. So Garaka promises to bust them out of jail if they help him. So they starts attracting people. So Slimer's living upstairs in the attic, and the whole subplot is Finn Wolfhard's character, like we said about Carrie Coon, tries to come down and be like, yo, there's something living in the attic. And she's just kind of like, you said you're an adult, you said you're 18, so be an adult. And he's like, fine. And so like to prove himself, he's like, I'm gonna handle this, which becomes like a running gag throughout the movie. You cut back to scenes of him going back upstairs, almost like Wile E. Coyote cartoon, like going back upstairs with another plan to catch Slimer, who's living in this huge, huge pile of merchandising, you know, for, you know, not in a bad way. I mean, it's one of the more clever merchandising or product placements I've seen. Yeah. Just put it all in one huge pile of everything and be like, yeah.
It's true.
Yeah, and there's like a whole Cheetos thing. Like, Cheetos is big in this. Like, yeah, but it's well done in that sense, because and he looks like dude from the X-Files. But, and of course, these schemes keep going wrong as he's trying to, you know, catch Slimer. And so there's like that's a whole subplot of the movie.
Yeah, so Slimer's not like, he's not like a hero like he is in the cartoons or anything like that, Rob. But he's also not just like, kind of a one-off thing. He's sort of a central joke. And it's like, you could see a scenario too where in like future films, he's still hanging out there and they're kind of used to him. Because he's not like menacing. He's just like eating their food and then, you know, running at them when they try and catch him and like sliming Finn Wolfhard multiple times. I mean, the literal last shot of the movie, I mean, a whole bunch of the ghosts get released as part of like Garaka. Yeah. So like, that's the other reason why, like we were sort of saying, you know, it could set up more ghost busting teams and stuff in the future, because like most of the ghosts are out now. And like one of the ghosts that's still out there is Slimer, and he's clearly shown at the end of the movie as part of kind of the closing gag. So it like that's sort of his place. But that, you know, I mean, that's like what works in the film, is they really do a good job, I think, of being like, people love, you know, the Slimer character. It's like they're in, Ray Stance is in the library at one point and sees the ghost that like, you know, charged after them in the library in the original film and stuff. So there's just like, you know, there's things like that where they're revisiting some of these places because it's taking place in New York and calling back to those practical special effects or like early, you know, early effects that, you know, we saw in those movies and stuff. So it feels very connected, like Kofi was saying, in the universe and everything.
And then the mini puffs are back. So they do like even the Stay Puff thing. And they're funny. I mean, like, because, like, at first they're, like, little and cute and mischievous, but then they always turn creepy and, like, do some, like, intense stuff, like grab knives and come for people. And it's, like,
and murderous.
Yeah, and there's even a little post-credit scene with them. And it's, like, So the signatures are all there, basically. Like, there's a lot of the callbacks in this are actually, like, fun.
Yeah, that's good. I genuinely liked Afterlife, so I'll see this one this weekend.
Yeah, you'll like it. I predict you will feel very similarly to us. You'll be like, yeah, there's a lot of shit in here, but like I had a great time. And
the effects with more time and not pandemic standards, the effects look much better too.
Yeah.
Right.
Like
right.
Garaka, Garaka looks, you know, he's like a CGI villain to some extent, but he looks creepy as fuck by the end.
Like, oh yeah.
Like he,
those scenes are genuinely kind of scary. Like,
All right, well, cool. X-Men 97. You guys know I haven't watched it yet. I have the screeners, but did not get around to it yet. But, yeah, I'm curious what you guys' initial impressions are.
I mean, the short of it is no surprise. It's pretty fucking awesome. Look, you guys know this. X-Men 97 is my all-time favorite animated series forever. And I think I mentioned this when we were talking about Airbender the other episode. But yeah, I mean, it's a very special show. It's a show that also, given its time frame, that thing launched in 92 on like a shoestring budget and no fucking timeline, and it crushed it. And it came out during the prime era of Marvel Comics, too. Those early 90s when they were selling hundreds of thousands of issues, and they launched X-Factor. And it was like the most iconic of these characters' costumes, right? You know what I mean? It was the Wolverine, blue and yellow. It was the Gambit thing. They keep these are the costumes they keep returning to in some form or another because they are the most iconic. And I think it was a brilliant idea by whoever pitched it, Brad Winterbaum, the EP, or Feige, whoever did it, once they got the rights from Fox, the idea of like continuing this and calling it X-Men 97 as the de facto sixth season and then continuing that continuity and the legacy was genius. And I'm sure you guys have seen the headlines. Like Feige's rule was like, hey, you can do it, but you got to bring back the music and the cast, to which they did. So everything about the show, before I pass it over, I just want to say on the technical side, like they did bring back the theme song, a bit of a remix. They kept the animation style, of course, made it HD and widescreen. There's slight differences, but they maintained the feel and the tone of it. And the music by the Newton brothers, who do all the score for this, like fucking incredible. Like I love it. And it does that nice thing where it works for kids, but I don't know if Kofi, you can speak to if you've seen episode 3 as well, but episode 3, which has not aired yet, I think they aired just the first two in the premiere, is like one of like the most adult tone. Darker themed visually episodes of the whole franchise. So they're finding a nice balance of like feeding the old audience, but also treating the new ones. And I had rewatched the original series when I was in university and rewatched it again a couple of years ago. And it totally held up music, the themes, oh my God, it's actually more relevant now than ever. Maybe one could argue given what they're covering in these episodes. And that's what's always been special about the X-Men, and their whole legacy for me. So, but yeah, I'm Kofi. I'm curious what your thoughts are. And if you've seen all three episodes yet.
I was ready to bury this shit. I didn't like the marketing. I didn't like the idea. I don't like any of these kind of really nostalgia things, whether it's like Batman 89 and Superman 79 comic books and shit like that. I can't stand any of this nostalgia retro stuff. So I was like, I don't know. I rewatched the X-Men cartoon and I don't agree that that holds up as well. That shit is rough.
Not for me.
Animation. Yeah, I mean, my son's starting to discover it, but like, even just as an adult, like, that shit is rough. 90s, DC was whipping their ass in the 90s. It's insane.
Those first two seasons, man, were made in like 7 months on nothing. It's bad. The fifth season, where they dumped the animation company or whatever, and Fox was trying to can it, it's really fucked because it looks totally different.
Yeah, there's a couple good seasons, but like, for the most part, It was a rough rewatch for a lot of episodes. There are some really good ones, but a lot of them are pretty rough. But in episode one didn't really grab me. I was just kind of – there's some really cheesy stuff to set up that we're in the 90s that is so anachronistic. Like Jubilee says Bling at one point in the early on, and Bling wasn't established till 99 with Cash Money Records and Bling. Nobody said that shit. There's like a rave scene with Sunspot. It's like, bitch, we were not glow stick raving in the 90s. Like that
was that music was a little more modern. Yeah.
I love
that.
And I was just like, okay. The animation style took me a minute to get back into. The voices, Rogue's voice is trash. I'm sorry. That sounds terrible. But then episode two hit. And my question in this was, my worry was these nostalgia plays are just empty. They're trying to like ape the stuff you liked when you were a kid, but you're now an adult and your perspective is different. And you're like, okay, that doesn't, I'm not a man child, so that doesn't really speak to me. But episode two reminded me, A, why I liked the animated series to begin with, because for as kind of goofy as it is, the line delivery and the dialogue is kind of hokey in a lot of them, but what it was getting to see the craziest X-Men comic concepts, like just perfectly lifted and transposed to TV, not having to change them for like live action or make them simpler or any of that. It was just straight up X-Men comics on TV. And sometimes they might have just like sped things up or streamlined how the stories unfolded, but essentially they were the stories. Episode two of X-Men 97 got me because in one episode, you get Magneto taking over as headmaster of the school from like the late 70s, 80s. The trial of Magneto from that same time. Storm's depowered arc, which happened in the 80s. Then the 90s Executioner saga. Like all in Friends of Humanity. All packed into one episode. And best of all, which made me, I didn't watch any screeners. And so what locked me into the show was that episode is, as Rob implied, the whole trial of Magneto in that sequence is as relevant to geopolitics right now as anything they did in the 90s. And finding this in an X-Men cartoon was like, wow, we are getting some more mature discourse about geopolitics right now and you know, current wars and skirmishes going on across the world right now than I've seen in like virtually any other media. So they made it relevant to today, which is the big trick that a lot of these nostalgic plays can't do. They can't make it feel like the thing we loved back then and still make it speak to us today. Episode two definitely established that we are going to do that with this show. And I've heard things about the subsequent episodes that give me confidence that this wasn't like a one-off fluke.
Yeah, you mentioned like four or five major arcs in the 70s, 80s that appear in episode two. You get multiple other ones regarding, you know, let's say Jean Grey's sort of legacy and the Summers family in the next episode. Like they are really setting up many, 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 many story arcs. And despite that, there are still characters we want to see more of. I know a lot of people were kind of down on poor Gambit because Rogue's relationship with Magneto and Gambit hasn't had a story yet, but I'm almost certain in episode four or five they'll set up some crazy stories for him as well. So, and we do know they wrote, by the way, we should speak about this too, the showrunner, main writer Beau DeMaio was fired from Marvel Studios like a week or two before this thing premiered, which was, and shut down all of his social media accounts. Very strange timing, but he had already pre-set up or wrote two seasons of the show. So I'm glad they approached us with two like complete arcs in mind already. And obviously I hope it continues past that, but very, very strange for Marvel. We were supposed to interview this guy on like a Friday and like 2 days before they're like, nope, he's fired.
That got real interesting for us too.
Yeah. We had some plans, some kind of unique plans there, and that very quickly got derailed. But yeah, so wait, Kofi, remind me, which episode do they have the big Sentinel battle? Was that the end of the first one?
That's the end of the first one.
That was dope too, though. You get to see Cyclops.
No, the Sentinel battle, but that was the end. No, the ending of the first episode is where I locked in. Specifically, when the Blackbird is flying, it gets blown to pieces. They all jump out of the plane, and Cyclops does that landing by blasting down into the desert and landing himself. And when Cyclops did that, I was like, holy shit, this is a badass Cyclops show. I'm in. Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
But even then, him versus the Friends of Humanity before that, where he's like moving around the room using his optic blast. There was a kind of
crazy. Yeah, we just talked about this on the hopefully award-winning comic book Nation about how much A, these showrunners fully understand, even more so than the previous show, you know, did the powers of the X-Men and how they work. And they also are borrowing something from Hickman in the Krakoa era, which is making their powers work in circuits with a lot more of them like doing shit together. That's fighting together with like the Gambit claws and all that. Like There's a lot of that in this show, and it's dope to see on the action front.
Yeah. The big sequence with Cyclops landing, Ben, when you see it, it's like, yeah, they actually just fucking gets annihilated. You're like, oh my God. And they're all following. And like, to them, it's like, no stress. Rogue will pick up these two. Morph can transform into some flying character. And who's the other flyer they have? Whatever. So three of them can fly, basically. And then as that's happening, as they're all being picked up or whatever, Cyclops is like smiling on his way down. He's like, I'll meet you down there. And you're like, wait a second, who's going to pick this guy up? And he just turns around and like confidently fucking blasts the column down to the ground. Essentially creates like a meteor crater and lands. And it's like, holy fuck. It's quite a, then he does his famous line where he summons the X-Men together. And it's like, holy crap. That's a kind of a powerful note. And to begin the third act of the first episode is baller. And I think 30 years of fans waiting to see Cyclops do something akin to what, you know, Joss Whedon made him do in the Astonishing X-Men or something where he's like more of a badass, was much appreciated. So pretty fucking cool sequence. And then you get something equally as badass with Magneto and these people putting him on trial, at the end of the second episode, and the way he speaks down to them, like he's a god, it was pretty amazing. So, yeah, really cool move so far. I'm really, really in love with it. It's nice to be enthused by something. Cause you guys know I'm not the biggest fan of What If, this is more my style. So I'm very excited to see it. Ben, don't wait to see this one like you did Daredevil season 3. Just watch it.
I'll do it. But yeah, it's not been I just haven't been like, I don't know. I just haven't been like actually watching that much shit the last week, but I have streamers and I like fully intended to, and then just
100% on Rotten Tomatoes. How about that?
I mean, I love the original cartoon. You said greatest animation series ever in one of your tweets about it.
Yes.
You honestly think that's better than the like Batman animated series?
Yeah. Batman was my close second for sure. Like Batman, those two shows were definitely my shit growing up. If other cartoons too, but those two are the ones that like definitely helped define my interests and are for me, the career in a large way. But X-Men was my number one jam for sure. I was absolutely obsessed with that. So, yeah, but both those shows are, you know, pretty much near perfect though, right? So yeah. I love the Spider-Man cartoon back then as well. So, X-Men number one for sure.
Okay, you guys wanted to talk about Roadhouse really quick.
Oh, yeah. Did you end up finishing the last scene there, Kofi?
No, I'm on the last sequence of the boat fight, but I mean...
Yeah, like, you don't need to...
Yeah, there's... I mean, we're just beating people and killing off some people. Like, I know what this is going, and I know what this movie was after I watched it.
This is good.
Look, it's not a complex movie, but I think it's very stylish. Look, I love... I actually quite like Doug Liman. He gets a lot of shit, but I actually quite liked his movie Jumper. I thought it had some kind of... It was visually fun. Had some cool action bits. I kind of wanted to see them continue that story. I really wish that movie had gotten a sequel to kind of see what they would do with that. Poor Hayden Christensen. I think my boy Jamie Bell's in that too. But this movie, look, it's a good action film. I know there was a bit of a weird kerfuffle at South by Southwest where Doug Liman did not want to promote the film at the premiere because he was in demand of a theatrical release, even though the agreement with Amazon is that it's a straight to Prime release. But I think this would have played well on the big screen because it's a very, it's a movie that finds mostly the right balance between like brutal action and kind of over the top craziness behind it. Not just the action itself, but the characters. Like it's really over the top. You kind of B movie corny level motivation behind a lot of these fights. As much as they try to go in depth behind our man, Jake Gyllenhaal's, you know, the reasoning behind who he is as sort of a disgraced MMA fighter and is kind of what kind of motivates him and what pushes him across the edge to become this fighter who can like kind of endure and enjoy pain in a way. You know what I mean? But yeah, look, what this movie does well is this over the top action scenes because they do a lot of stylish stuff with the cinematography. It looks weird at first and you have to kind of adjust to it, but there are some sequences where in the middle of a fight, it'll transition to like a first person element a little bit from Jake's perspective. And other times the camera will follow the movement of the person or the arm. And it's very kinetic and also how they use the environment and objects in some of these fights. And there's enough through line with some of the side characters that kind of make it mostly enjoyable. And then of course, Conor McGregor shows up and he's just the most over the top thing I've ever seen. Even the way he fucking walks is over the top, but it's funny. And you're rooting for him to get his ass kicked at some point. Right. So, it's a decent actioner. It's a great, perfect for Prime Video, who I think, you know, Prime obviously very into the modern action genre. You know, you look at all their shows, they greenlight everything from Reacher to all the Tom Clancy stuff with Jack Ryan and even the Terminal List, which they're now making prequels for. They love
fucking modern action type stuff. And this is kind of that. So Ben, I think it's worth a watch. It's not a rush to see it, but it's a movie that would have played well on the big screen had it given the chance, but it's a, you know, it's a fun visceral actioner that not something you're going to think about after you watch it sort of thing.
Yeah.
You
know? Cool.
Yeah.
Is that how you felt about it, Kofi?
Yeah, I think it's one of those that's like great to be at home for Saturday night and put on and watch. It's weird. It's kind of offbeat, but the first Roadhouse was also a very weird movie, which has this extreme beginning of a guy ripping out a guy's throat and then has him be kind of zen and fighting and doing spin kicks and tight pants the rest of the time. Yeah, and so it was a weird movie, as most Patrick Swayze movies were. So this one is weird. Jake Gyllenhaal's pretty good. I think a lot of people on Comic Book Nation, we were debating the Conor McGregor factor. I feel like having Conor McGregor in this was hilarious. I think him just being over the top and hamming it up works in a movie like this, because this movie is not serious about itself.
No,
it's never serious about itself at any point. Like, it's always weird and offbeat. Jake Gyllenhaal, like, there's a whole scene in the beginning of Jake Gyllenhaal taking a knife to his ribs and then like just trying to fix him up, talking to this, you know, the girl who runs the bar, and while trying to put duct tape on himself, and her being like, dude, like, don't you want to go to the hospital? And he's like, nah. And then like, yeah, that whole thing. And you get like just how unserious this movie is. It's a lot of him just walking around the town, having these weird encounters with people. And it's like, it's just kind of Roadhouse in that way. And the amount of times he actually uses violence in this movie, there are just a couple scenes, because most of the time it's him trying to just not do things, or knowing he can fuck you up so badly that it's literally a Hulk thing. He's like, yeah, I don't want to get mad because I don't want to fuck people up. And so, yeah, it's a weird movie, but I disagree with people who were like, oh, this should have gotten a theatrical release. No, the fuck it shouldn't have. There's nothing in this that needs to be on a theater screen. And the ADR, I listened to it in my headphones, is terrible in this. Like, there are so many bad dialogue drops and sound drops.
Really? I didn't notice that when I watched it. Huh.
Yeah, watch it again. Put on some headphones, watch it, and you'll see. There's so many redubbings and things like that. Like, some of the construction's is a little rough. But it's Doug Liman, who knows how to direct a movie. And there are scenes that are really in, you know, where it does get serious, where it's like pretty well done. Like the scene where you find out like what made Gyllenhaal's character get to this point, and like what happened is he has a scene with Billy Magnussen, who we know from like Game Night and a bunch of other stuff. And
Aladdin, yeah, come on.
Aladdin. I haven't seen the new Aladdin. I never watched the new Aladdin. So I have no idea. Yeah.
Gotcha.
My kids were too young at the time.
That's fair.
So yeah. And like, that's a really, then you're like, oh wait, this is a guy who's like an experienced director and knows how to direct like drama and thrillers and things like that. And so like, yeah, but it's more of a comedy film. Like, there's a lot of just weird, funny things in this. Like, there's a whole thing with J.D. Pardo from Mayans MC, who has a whole arc in this
that yeah, like really ends weird.
In the most bizarre way. Like, yeah.
His character's so weird too. Like,
exactly.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, but I'm saying, but that's kind of what makes this film fun and different is like, yeah, he plays this like really over the top, like 80s bully, bar bully. And, you know, there's a whole sequence where Jake Gyllenhaal eventually just thrashes these guys. And then this movie is different because he's like, ah, shit, now I got to like take you to the hospital. And there's a whole sequence of them taking them to the hospital and driving these guys. He just like beat the living crap out of. And taking them into the hospital to get help and like the whole inconvenience of that. And so it's pretty funny, like in that sense. Cause
yeah,
Arturo Castro, who's like in The Menu and a bunch of other stuff. And he had that show for a while on Comedy Central, like so many comics do. Like, he plays like J.D. Pardo's like the nicer of the bar bully, yeah, who keeps coming back around and has this weird arc in the movie where he just keeps seeing Jake Gyllenhaal. Because at first he like really fucks him up, and like he's the guy he has to take to the hospital. It's in the trailers where he's like, oh, I just broke that guy's arm.
Yeah.
And he's like, okay, see you later. And every time he sees that guy again, that guy's like, oh shit. Like, oh man, like, I don't want any more violence from you. Like, I'm good. And he sees him at some pretty extreme moments in this movie. Because like the first film, what's weird about this is this guy a hero or a serial killer, right? Like, there's always this weird line where Swayze's Dalton, you're like, he's made out to be this majestic hero, but you're like, bro, I don't forget you ripped a guy's throat out in the beginning of this.
This is the same thing with a slightly more nuance, but the weird layer, the meta layer is like, so not to get too much details, Ben, you probably don't care about this, but like when he comes to this town and agrees to do this for money, whatever, the first thing he comes across is like a little bookstore with a girl there. And that's kind of like your foil, right? A nice young, innocent girl who's in this shitty world, whatever. And like the meta layer is like she in this bookstore, like, she kind of thinks of, they basically call out this is like a modern Western in a way. And he's the guy coming into the saloon to fix shit up, but he's got the dark past. Is he a hero or is he not? They directly talk about that as the extra layer. And in the end, it's very clear. He's not a hero, but he's not the bad guy either, sort of thing, which is obvious given the nature of what this film is. But yeah, the villains, I'll say this, to add to what Kofi was saying, that is the best part of the film. Cause like they give all these, there's like layers and groups of little villains and they're all over the top, like Kofi said, but they let them all speak, which is the funniest shit. Cause they all have like weird little personality quirks. You know what I mean? Like their ex cop who thinks there's a badass. There's the guy Kofi's talking about with the busted arm. Who's like really kind of innocent and kind of likable. And the way they describe Dalton is like, oh, he's really kind of nice and polite until you cross the line, then he's going to fucking destroy you. But yeah, so it's quirky and unique in that way. So yeah, I agree. It's definitely would have been the perfect. I would have liked to seen the action stuff from the big screen. I think it would have played well, although it absolutely would have bombed theatrically. But it is the perfect sort of action rental, or in this case, streaming at home on Prime. But yeah, it's fun. It's way better than I expected it to be. And a lot of it has to do with like the weirdness and the layers to these side characters and villains. And the other part of it is the style they bring to it. The same way Lyman brought a very unique dynamic to the action and Jumper or some of his other action films. He even did that fucking Tom Cruise one, right? What was it called? American Made or something? Anyways, he has a very unique shooting style when it comes to kinetic sequences. So, yeah, worth watching.
Oh, the Drug Runner, American.
Yeah, was it American Made, right? Was it? I think it was American Made or something like that, but I forget. Anyways, yeah, decent film.
Welcome.
Yep, American Made.
There you go.
All right. Well, those are the three things that we wanted to cover this week. Kept it a bit brief, but we will try and hook up with everyone again next week. Mr. Rob Keyes, where can people find you on the internet?
Yeah, you can follow me on Twitter at Rob_Keyes. That's KEYES. And you can check out our happenings on screenrant.com.
All right. I'm Ben Kendrick. You can follow me at Ben Kendrick on most of the socials. Check out what we're doing over at Static Media. And Mr. Kofi Outlaw.
You can find me on comicbook.com for my written work and at Comic Book Nation on all podcast streams for my podcast work.
Awesome. If you haven't given us a rating or review, please do so in your podcast platform of choice. That helps us spread word about the show. We will be back probably next week. I guess it's Kong X Godzilla week, or Godzilla X Kong week, Godzilla plus Kong week, whatever. So maybe we'll get... Do you have a screening for that, Kofi?
Are you allowed to say? Not know yet.
Okay. I think I'm seeing it on Tuesday, so I will have at least seen it, so I can give a preview of that next week if we are able to make time to podcast. All right, that'll do it, guys. We'll see y'all next week. Bye.
Bye.